It's time for KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for listening to your radio and for joining us on Twitter at KUOW. What if police officers showed up at someone's home with a mental health professional by their side? Could that prevent a shooting like the killing of Seattle's Charlena Lyles? You're going to hear about how that mental health response happens in Tacoma now and maybe soon statewide. So that's coming up in about 20 minutes. I hope you can stay tuned.
By the power vested in me by the Constitution and laws of the United States, I declare that from this day forward, each of you is a citizen of the United States of America. Congratulations.
Yes, it is the 5th of July, so for some people, their first full day as newly minted American citizens. That was Federal Judge Richard Tallman administering the oath yesterday at the city's annual naturalization ceremony at Seattle Center. More than 500 people from 69 countries took the oath of allegiance and became U.S. citizens. Here are some thoughts from our newest citizens.
Acceptance of all, no matter what background or religion or ethnicity or social structure or class you came from, it accepts you no matter what.
I feel like this is now even more important to become American and in this climate, and I feel like my life is here, my families and friends are here, and and I've adopted, this is kind of like my second home, so.
Oh, it feels the best, and this is the best thing ever happened to me.
I love this country. I respect this country. I'm happy to be your citizen. God bless America.
It feels great. Yeah. Have that just sort of checkbox done. It feels wonderful.
Why did you want to become a citizen?
So I wanted to become a citizen because my family's here, because I believe in this country too, and I really love what it stands for. So it was just, for me, it was just the right next step. I just see that the Seattle people are just very, just received us with open arms. They are very accepting, very loving. I enjoy the diversity that I can find here in the city of Seattle.
What are the things you want to do as a citizen that you're most looking forward to?
Number one, participate in the voting process. That's my main priority.
That was Gary Singh and Juan Salvador and Gerardo Martinez, Olga Kolesnik and Dea Somontri and Luis Felipe Garcia. Six new American citizens naturalized yesterday at Seattle Center, and they talked with KUOW's Casey Martin. This is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Now, while Americans shot off 4th of July fireworks yesterday, North Korea had a display of its own, a nuclear missile test. And this was not the shorter-range missiles that Kim Jong-un has tested before. This is one that could hit Alaska anyway. Could it hit Seattle? Let's learn more from research analyst Kent Boydston at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Kent.
Thanks for having me.
This is a ballistic missile, which means you aim it upward and then it comes down somewhere thanks to gravity, right?
Yeah, so it is an ICBM test, and this... The intercontinental aspect of this ballistic missile is what is making more people upset right now compared to some of the other tests. And this is, of course, particularly in the United States, which is, of course, much farther away from North Korea than, say, Japan or South Korea. But yes, they are testing their ICBM capabilities, as they've said they are going to do. It appears that we should be not surprised, but they are continuing to carry this out.
And this is capable of reaching Alaska, I've heard, although it fell in the Sea of Japan. How do we know where it could go?
Yeah, so right now it looks like it has the capacity to go as far as somewhere in Alaska. Now, why the North Koreans would want to shoot an ICBM at the Aleutian Islands, they probably don't. That probably wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. But the real concern here is that they're improving their capabilities. They're being able to shoot these ballistic missiles farther and farther. And, right now, they're probably not too far away in terms of distance from getting one to reach Hawaii, which is a bit farther than Alaska as the islands stretch out.
That is
the concern, yeah.
Not to be parochial here, but what about the capability of hitting Seattle?
Yeah, so it does not appear that they have that capability yet, but we can be quite certain that the North Koreans are working on getting capabilities that can strike further and further in to the U.S. homeland. And this is something that the North Koreans have wanted to do, and it's something that they say they're working on, and we should believe that aspect, that they are certainly trying. So one of the other, for the U.S., it's a psychological threat almost to be able to for the North Koreans to be able to strike the main part of the United States or one of the United States the continental United States. But actually, in South Korea and Japan, I mean, they've been under threat from North Korean missiles for much longer. You don't need an ICBM to hit South Korea or Japan. And, it's kind of an interesting dynamic with our allies in South Korea and Japan, because we are bound legally bound to defend them, and we have troops in both of those countries, South Korea and Japan. So if they were attacked, we would have to get involved, and we would surely be involved. But when it's capabilities to strike the U.S. mainland, somehow that's a more of a psychological threat, even that the North Koreans could have a missile that could actually strike somewhere like San Francisco or Seattle.
Well, Kat, as you said, you don't know why Kim Jong-un would want to shoot at the Aleutian Islands.
Yeah.
I could say the same for Seattle or San Francisco or Seoul or Tokyo. I mean, what does Kim Jong-un want?
Right. So what Kim Jong-un wants here is a strong deterrent. So it is unlikely that Kim Jong-un, unless he was feeling just very suicidal, would start launching missiles all over at our allies, or eventually at United States territory. But if Kim Jong-un knows that he can threaten the United States to the degree that we feel more handcuffed if there is some kind of crisis situation in North Korea, then it's going to mean that the U.S. has fewer strategic options. And, I mean, you can look at the case of Libya when what happened with Gaddafi, where the United States was not on friendly terms with Gaddafi, but at the highest level of adversarial relations with Gaddafi, not that much before he fell, and the United States got involved when there was a crisis situation in Libya. And the North Koreans saw that. They saw that example, and they cite it. You know, the North Koreans will say, you know, the case of what happened to Libya, or what happened to Syria even more recently when Trump launched some missiles after the chemical attack. So, the North Koreans will say, you know what, we saw what the United States can do and what they're willing to do, and we're not going to let that happen. And if North Korea has a capability to strike the United States with a nuclear weapon, and I don't think they have it yet, but eventually, then it's really going to cause a lot more pause for the United States policymakers.
Yes, you point out that this is not... Kim Jong-un, as far as we know, cannot yet put a nuclear warhead on this intercontinental ballistic missile. What has President Trump's response been to this ICBM test so far that we know of?
Yeah, so far, President Trump has responded in a few different ways. One is he tweeted something shortly after, saying something to the effect of, does this guy have nothing better to do with his time regarding Kim Jong-un? Mm-hmm. And then early this morning, he actually tweeted about China and North Korea trade, saying that China was increasing their trade with North Korea, and you know, appearing skeptical that China was doing their best to curtail these North Korean aggressions on the sanctions front. So those were two things in the Twittersphere. Another action that happened was the U.S. and South Korea conducted some ballistic missile tests of their own. And these were directed at, these were often to the ocean. I mean, they were not directed at Pyongyang, but the intent of this message from this test was, we can do surgical strikes on Pyongyang, and if you guys try anything, we're more than ready to strike as well. So those are the actions that have been taken thus far.
Given President Trump's options, what do you think he's going to do?
Well, it's very hard to say what President Trump will do, but reading a little bit of the tea leaves, this is what I think might happen. So he tweeted this morning about China-North Korea trade and how China was increasing or had increased its trade with North Korea, and just being skeptical about China doing its share to clamp down on North Korea. And that came pretty shortly after the ICBM missile test. You know, I think those were related. What Trump can do is he can start to implement more of these so-called secondary sanctions on Chinese firms that deal with illicit North Korean activities. And actually, last week, the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control listed more entities, and Chinese this time. And so President Trump and the U.S. government can say, you know what, China, we don't think that you have done as much as you could, and we've been hesitant to designate your firms before. But now we think it's gotten too far, and we're going to take measures into our own hands. And looking at what happened last week with the new sanctions designation, and then what Trump has tweeted this morning, I think it's entirely possible, even likely, that the United States is going to have more sanctions against Chinese firms that are dealing with North Korea coming forward.
Okay. Well, we'll see what happens next. Finally, Kent, if you lived in Seattle, would you lose a wink of sleep tonight?
Well, you know, I think that still the deterrence holds, and North Korea doesn't have the capability to strike Seattle. So I wouldn't lose sleep tonight if I were in Seattle. That being said, I don't want to downplay the risk of North Korea just developing its weapons and just how it can mess up the entire strategic balance.
Well, thanks for making us a little smarter about it, Kent. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Kent Boydston, research analyst at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C., and the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, has just finished speaking at a UN meeting. She tweeted yesterday, spending my July 4th in meetings. Hashtag thanks, North Korea. Nikki Haley just wrapped up a talk at a UN meeting. She called the missile launch from North Korea, quote, a clear and sharp military escalation, and said it calls for an escalated American response. We will bring you more on this story all day long here on KUOW. The BBC coming up next, All Things Considered, later this afternoon, so stay tuned. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. How did Charlena Lyles die at the hands of Seattle police, and why? Police shot Lyles in her apartment last month. Officers said she threatened them with a knife. It looks like there will be an inquest into her death. King County is the only county in Washington state that holds inquests to investigate officer-involved shootings. KUOW reporter Amy Radel explains what an inquest is and what it is not.
Attorneys for police officers and for members of the public agree on one thing. Inquests are stressful for everyone involved. Derek Isaacson is a lawyer in Seattle who represents police officers.
Anytime that an officer has had to use force that's resulted in someone's death, it's very difficult for that officer. So they're essentially having to relive that in open court in front of the public in front of a jury, and they have to provide them with that information, and it's having to relive it.
Knowing questions of criminal and civil liability are still looming. But this replay of events is precisely why King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg says inquests are valuable.
And the investigation is revealed in open court where anybody can watch it. So in that, I will defend that process as superior to one that happens entirely on paper.
At the inquest, a jury answers questions about the circumstances of the person's death, including whether officers feared for their safety. The findings go to the prosecutor and may be used in civil lawsuits. But families of the deceased often find the inquest itself too limited. At the inquest for Muckleshoot tribal member Renee Davis last May, her family wanted to ask how deputies are trained to check on people who are suicidal. But attorney Bree Blackhorse says the judge made it clear that topic was not on the table.
At the outset and at the end, the court told the family this isn't going to be a satisfactory process. The questions that the family really wants answered are more appropriate for a civil suit.
A lawsuit they're now preparing to file. But some families can't afford to bring a civil suit. Others say they want to help change policing and prevent future deaths. Pierce Murphy directs Seattle's Office of Professional Accountability, which investigates complaints against Seattle police. He says SPD does look at training and prevention, but it's behind closed doors.
And that's the force review process that has been created as a result of the settlement agreement between the Department of Justice and the City of Seattle. Unfortunately, that process is not a public process.
Attorney Corey Gilmette represented the family of Shea Taylor at a recent inquest. Taylor was killed in an encounter with Seattle police last year. Gilmette says he wants inquests to consider broader questions.
I think a lot of people think an inquest is to determine whether a shooting was justified or a killing was justified, and it really is. It does not do that and cannot do that.
Gilmette says another frustration he had was there's no right to appeal a judge's limitations and no way to challenge an officer's statement if lawyers believe it's incorrect.
We can't do anything about it. There is no opening statements. There are no closing statements. We can't call another witness to rebut what they said, and so it just stands.
But police attorney Derek Isaacson says if the inquest process is changed dramatically, it may not serve a purpose anymore. He says inquests originated in a time when it was hard to get the facts of a case. Now, he says, victims' families could file public records requests and proceed with their own lawsuits.
And the reality is, aren't you just then moving into a civil liability issue at that point? You're trying to lay blame as opposed to, listen, let's just look at what the facts are. And that's the idea of the inquest process from my perspective.
Bree Blackhorse says ultimately Renee Davis's family found the inquest process useful. But that's largely because the family and the Muckleshoot tribe were able to hire lawyers to represent them. There's no provision to appoint public defenders if a family can't afford that. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
And tomorrow on KUOW, we're going to bring you the story of a couple whose son was killed by police in 2009. They have some big problems with the inquest process, so we'll get into that tomorrow on KUOW Seattle. So a lot of people in this town are asking, could Charlena Lyles still be alive today if police had not gone to her apartment alone? Well, in Tacoma, an officer can call for help dealing with someone who might be mentally ill. They can call a mental health co-responder. And now this co-responder program might go statewide. So let's learn about it with Tacoma Patrol Officer John Hill and a mental health co-responder who works with officers, Ryan Miles. Welcome to both of you.
Welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Officer Hill, you're in Tacoma. You cannot speak to what happened with Charlena Lyles in Seattle. But is that a kind of case where you're coming to the home of someone who's been referred to mental health treatment? Is that the kind of case where you would call a mental health co-responder to be with you?
Specifically to mental health, for sure. If we show up on scene, we want to make sure the scene is safe before we would call them and allow them to do their job. So it's specific case-to-case basis.
Ryan, what happens when you and an officer like John team up on a call? How's that go?
It's pretty interesting and good. It's the officers tend to have a good rapport with individuals when we arrive. You know, people tend to respect law enforcement, and we're able to provide a different angle of approach to help build rapport, and then also give that resource connection in terms of what services they might need.
A different approach, how?
Just in the sense that, you know, I know what's available and what they might need in terms of treatment.
What would be an example of that for us?
So, like, we have a facility called RRC that we have access to in Tacoma, and it's a facility that is a little bit more open and friendly than like an inpatient facility. So someone who's had a history of being detained or at an inpatient facility might have a lot of hesitance with wanting to go back into the mental health system. So I can help kind of guide them and say, well, we have this other resource that's a little bit more open, a little bit more friendly into maybe what you've had before, and just try and kind of build that relationship to make them feel comfortable with whatever we're trying to get done that day.
Officer, when would you call somebody like Ryan and why?
Well, sometimes we've actually become partners, per se, on Tuesdays. He'll ride with me. And so he'll go to my calls that I typically deal with that might not be deal with mental health. And he'll either stay in the car, like such as like a ride-along was to do. However, if I do show up on a mental health, someone suffering from mental illness, he'll be there and he'll step in. And, I mean, he's a professional. I've only had 40 hours of mental health,
training.
I've got 9 years experience, which has also helped me considerably. But he would be there, and if he was there, he would kind of step in. And
how so? How might that go?
You know, obviously, like I said, we'll make sure the scene is safe. And instead of myself, you know, in uniform, maybe be a little intimidating, he can break down that barrier and talk to him. I can step.
Why? What would you be wearing, Ryan?
I do wear a vest. I don't have a belt on with any additional equipment, so it is a little more intimidating than maybe a typical crisis worker. But we do have patches that identify us as mental health workers, and that does give us a little bit more leeway in terms of them being less intimidated by us.
Because you look like an officer to me, to the untrained eye. Like, you look very official. And do you carry a gun?
I do not, no.
Wow, you don't know what you're about to encounter. I know Officer Hill said you're going to make sure it's safe first, but geez, how do you know that?
We put a lot of trust in the officers that we're coming into a scene okay.
Yeah, but that sounds dangerous to me, to show up unarmed. I mean, it's dangerous enough to be armed,
right?
But what's it like for you?
You know, initially it was a little daunting, I'll say. We do have a vest that gives a little bit of sense of security in case something were to happen.
A bulletproof vest.
Yes, yes. Yeah. But having been working with the officers, experienced with, you know, going on many calls prior to even knowing that we existed, I feel very comfortable when they call us out on scene.
And officer, how does it go differently? What does Ryan add to a situation involving someone who's maybe mentally ill?
Sure.
How does he change your job?
Well, he's got a considerable extra amount of resources that he can at his disposal. He's got phone numbers and relationships with people in the medical field that we don't. We're kind of just first line. So if I was to go to the hospital, I show up in the ER versus he could potentially call the individual's caseworker, or he could call a boss or the person's counselor or something like that.
Can't do that? You don't have access to those kind of records as a police officer?
No, it's all HIPAA restricted.
Yeah, HIPAA is the Privacy Act.
Exactly. So he's able to, because he's part of the medical field, he's able to get into that and really account for the subject's history, their mental health history. If it's not written by a police officer, I can't read it.
How about the interpersonal dealing with this human being who you're showing up to deal with in some way? I'll ask Ryan too, but I want to ask you as a police officer, how do you do your job any differently because of this program that might go statewide? You're working with a mental health co-responder. In that moment, give us an example of how that can go.
All right, regarding like myself showing up without him versus with him?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, how would he... That's right. So, you know, I'm imagining you at somebody's doorstep, you know, or so they've opened their door and you're dealing with them, but they might have mental health real troubles. Mm-hmm. And how does working with someone like Ryan change how you deal with that person?
Ryan's able to pinpoint their condition a lot easier than I do. Like I said, I have 40 hours of CIT training. So he's
a crisis intervention training.
Crisis intervention training, yes, exactly. It could go as far as medications. I'm not a professional when it comes to medications, let alone being able to read the names of them. He knows what they're provided, what their use is. So if he asks them, hey, what type of medication are you using? And the subject was to provide that. Ryan could tell, okay, he's being treated for this, this, and this, which is incredibly beneficial. Are you on your medication? No. Okay, well, then maybe that's why we're acting the way we're acting today. And he could provide a better resource than myself saying, I really don't know what your typical baseline is. You're acting this way. I only can take you to the hospital to provide help. And they're, incredibly busy themselves. Or I can take you to what we call, he said earlier, recovery response center. And that's really our two little lifelines of what we can provide for that individual. Ryan can go back and he can actually come up with a considerably better resolution for that subject.
Ryan, how do you deal with somebody so you've shown up now, it's been considered safe, mm-hmm. So now you're on the scene with this officer. It could be a really scary situation, a tense situation, I don't know. This person's, you can tell they've got some kind of mental issues on board. How are you helping in that moment?
Well, I think I don't want to take anything away from the officers. I've been more than impressed on numerous occasions with how they deal with individuals, even those that are having a very serious situation with the mental illness. I think the benefit when I'm on scene is that I can provide a different approach to interacting with the individual, different cadence, a different style that maybe the officer is using that the individual will respond better to.
What do you mean? Well, how would be a different style? Give me an example.
So maybe, because when officers are on scene, sometimes they're directive, right? They have to make sure the scene is safe. They want you to do X, Y, Z. And my approach from being a crisis mental health worker is much more, how can we help you today? How do you want this to be resolved today? And just take a different approach that sometimes the individual responds better to.
I'm guessing you hate the cliche, good cop, bad cop, but I am thinking of,
sometimes, it's a powerful tool sometimes.
Yes, talk about that.
It's just some individuals, I can't speak to a specific situation, I guess, which would help, but some people benefit from that, here's what's going on today. This is one option that can happen, or let's talk about some other options that are going to benefit you better in the long run.
Are you in that position, Officer Hill, of kind of being, because I've talked to officers before who, for example, they'll say, this is in our training, is the first thing is put the weapon down or whatever it is. It's like directive was the polite word that Ryan used, but sometimes you're trying to establish sort of authority here, right? And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are you in that position of you and Ryan kind of being the two different personalities on the scene?
I think Ryan and I mesh pretty well as far as that goes. I guess a benefit of having Ryan overall has allowed me to kind of maybe change my police approach.
Really?
To mental illness. Watching him work has made me a different officer, So I take more time with the individual, try to establish better rapport, get a common ground with that individual. It's helped me just become a more well-rounded officer. And I've seen it work, so I know it does. Just for example, something I've learned is if that subject that's suffering from mental illness has an imaginary friend, okay, let's say that it does happen, okay, he's seeing someone that's not there. Instead of just dismissing that completely, and which other people have probably been doing, that's given him more of a heartache, why don't we just include him? What's it hurting? If his friend, his name is Fred, hey, let's include Fred in this conversation. And it's allowed you to just really create a common ground with that guy, and he's trusting you. Hey, I see Fred. Okay, hey, is Fred doing all right? Can we get yourself and Fred help today? Can we take you to get some food or shelter or the hospital or something like that? And it's really allowed them to, be able to trust us more.
Yeah, that's interesting. So Ryan, people like you have kind of changed the police culture.
Yeah.
We hear this phrase, a warrior culture. Is there room for that to change? And as a mental health co-responder, changing that dynamic?
I think it's changing to what they call the guardian now.
Mm-hmm.
Does it matter that you both of you guys are white men? Does that matter? Does that come up in your training? Does that change anything?
I think to a degree it could maybe benefit. I think at the end of the day though, with my contacts, I don't think it impacts it that much. I see people of all types and flavors. And when you can get down to their level and get common ground, like John said, you can have a real conversation with someone regardless of that. I think it hasn't been an issue for us. There are situations though, like my partner's a female, the other co-responder, and there are situations where an individual might respond better to a female than a male.
Do you ever come in conflict? You know, you've got two different approaches and really two different jobs that you're trying to do in that moment. Does that ever conflict?
A police officer works.
Yeah, how so?
Everything works. I mean, it might not be working for that person that day, okay? Everything I can help and try to provide just might not be enough. But at the end of the day, we try to create a positive contact at most. So if we do come in contact with that subject again, which we might, highly likely, that it was a positive contact and that we can, you know, build on that.
You know, you say it's highly likely you're going to contact that person again, which makes me think of how many times one person can interact with the mental health system. And I mean, in the case of in Seattle, Charlena Lyles had gone to mental health treatment, and if it helped, we sure can't tell. So if your goal is to keep people out of jail, is diversion, as they say, but you know, but then what? Now they're in the system, and then what, Ryan?
Well, I think we're a part of that too, because when we're having repeated contact, we're maybe encouraging them to continue services, or we're encouraging them to go to their appointment that day, or whatever the case is, we're helping to, you know, you don't want to see us every day, so how can we get you, you know, back on the right track?
But how confident do you feel walking away that this person's going to be taken care of and get some help?
That's a case-by-case answer. I think more often than not, I feel pretty confident with the resolution we come up with. But at the end of the day, it's really up to the individual more than not if they're going to partake in services that are available.
Well, because we're talking about the state legislature could take this. You're in Tacoma. Mm-hmm. We could take this program statewide. Any concerns about that? Any advice to make this work statewide?
I think one of my concerns is and we kind of do it already, but every county doing it a little differently and not a lot of collaboration between counties. And I think that's been a big hurdle and problem in the mental health system in general. And if we just do it again with another new system, it may not be the best.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's our time for today. As I said, we're talking with John Hill, a patrol officer with Tacoma Police Department, Ryan Miles, a designated mental health professional who works with John and other Tacoma police officers as a mental health co-responder. And this is in Tacoma. We're talking about possibly taking this program statewide. So thanks for coming in and talking to us about, in a way, it sounds like a common sense partnership, you know, police officer, mental health professional. But it hasn't always happened that way, and maybe it'll happen more. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
It's KUOW's The Record. We'll be back in just a moment. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. This spring, a tunnel at Hanford Nuclear Reservation collapsed. The collapse was a surprise. Nobody knew exactly why it happened or what it meant for all of the other nuclear waste storage sites at Hanford. Well, the Department of Energy has been trying to figure this out, and KUOW reporter Anna King has been poring through the DOE's report on the collapse.
So they came up with three main reasons that they think this tunnel might have collapsed. One was the materials or the construction methods of the tunnel itself. Two is just time. They had this tunnel in for a long, long time, decades, and it just wasn't designed to last that long. And then thirdly, we had a really wet winter and spring this year. Usually out here, we only get about 7 inches of rain. We got tons more snow and rain than that. And that kind of created this load, this heavy load in the soil that covers the tunnel and perhaps made it just too heavy to sustain.
And will you remind us why it matters so much, how this tunnel collapsed?
Well, officials are really worried that if the tunnel was to further collapse, that a plume of radioactive dust could go airborne and perhaps go across the site or even off the site into neighboring communities. And that's really worrying. They don't want any radioactive constituents getting off the site, but especially not airborne ones that can just float anywhere. And so they have done a lot of stuff to try and mitigate that, putting a tarp over that tunnel to keep the dust down if it did collapse further.
And as I mentioned, Hanford's got other nuclear waste storage sites. What else could go wrong at Hanford?
Well, there's a lot that could go wrong at Hanford. Key point is there's 56 million gallons of radioactive sludge waste that is in aging underground tanks. Now, those are kind of like World War II battleships and Cold War era battleships. If you think about the salty air in Seattle and how metal reacts with that, well, think about these things underground since World War II and the Cold War holding all this radioactive sludge. And it's just a little ways from the Columbia River. So nobody wants those to leak more than they already have. They've already leaked about a million gallons. Then there's a K basin built in the 50s. It's filled with waste and it's just a little bit from the Columbia River, and it has sludge and waste inside it as well. And then there's these trenches filled with waste like lab coats and beakers and liquids, all in these like Simpson-style kind of barrels. And they dig those trenches up and try to repackage that waste and put it into a more safe configuration. But there's a lot of that that remains to be done. And often in these barrels, they just don't know what's in there. They have to x-ray them and look at them with different equipment to figure out what could be inside. There's liquids and other dangerous things. And then there's this really big facility that holds 2,000 cesium and strontium capsules in a huge pool. It actually is so radioactive hot that it glows green or blue color. And it's highly radioactive stuff, and it's some of Hanford's largest amount of radioactivity is stored in these capsules. And it needs to be put into dry storage. And that's because if we were to have a huge earthquake, this facility is really old, and it could end up being something like a Fukushima-type event where they're worried about these capsules overheating if the water was to drain out. And then finally, we have the groundwater. We have these massive plumes of stuff like hexavalent chromium and radioactive constituents that are under the ground in the desert soil running with the groundwater towards the Columbia River. Now, there's huge pump and treat facilities that are working on that, but they really need to clean up those water plumes before they get to the Columbia, where many communities draw their water.
Anna, I'm feeling happy to have a mountain range in between me and Hanford right now. So as for this tunnel that collapsed in the spring that I mentioned, you've made a video explaining that collapse, and we're tweeting that out right now at KUOW. What kind of stuff was inside that tunnel?
So the tunnel was mainly used for big pieces of equipment that couldn't fit in a waste dump somewhere else. So if they were too big and too hot with radioactive constituents, then they would put it on this train and drive it with a remote locomotive under the ground into these tunnels that were right near the plant. And I think the plan was eventually like, okay, we'll figure out how to dispose of that waste in a better way. But the plan just never has been implemented, and so it's just been sitting there all this time. And when they see pictures of this stuff, which you can see online on some of my reports that I've done in the past, they're just massive. They fill up whole train cars with equipment. And so it's really unwieldy waste to work with. And some of them have like cavities inside of them that could be holding water or other stuff. So the engineers right now are really trying to figure out how is the best way to stabilize this waste. And they think what they're going to do is pour in layer cake grout kind of in layers to make sure that all of that stuff is solidified and can't dust up anything.
So nobody got stuck in that tunnel when it fell in? Nobody died? Are Hanford workers feeling like they got off easy with this collapse?
I think that Hanford never takes emergencies lightly, and we are all grateful that no one was hurt or killed in this incident. But it goes to show that there's just a lot out at Hanford that we need to keep watch on. There's hundreds and hundreds of these waste sites. The ones I mentioned earlier are just the big boys. But these, you know, there's all these infrastructures and buildings and sheds and tanks. And if you don't keep a good eye on it, it could go bad. And some of these places are only really looked at every decade or so. So there's just so much out here that people are really worried there's not enough funding to keep an eye on all of it and to make all of it safe.
Finally, Anna, you've been covering Hanford for years. Beyond the federal funding, what big questions do you have moving forward?
Right. So the big one is again, that federal budget. They are going to cut $120 million if Trump's budget goes through. So that would curtail quite a bit of cleanup already going on at the site, and no new cleanup would be started. And some programs like groundwater or other programs might be cut back quite severely. Also, you know, I'm wondering if they can get that waste treatment plant up and running, really. It's a huge behemoth of a plant. It's very, very complicated. It looks like downtown Seattle in the middle of the desert. There's sand on the ground and gravel, and then up above you are these skyscraper buildings that are trying to clean up that radioactive sludge waste. And they just haven't been able to get like inertia to finish it. I mean, they've been building it and building it and building it. And everyone's wondering, is that going to be an albatross out in the middle of the desert? Or is it actually going to work? In 2000, they were supposed to only spend about $4 billion on the total plant, and it was supposed to be running by 2011. Well, now they're saying that possibly it could cost as much as $17 billion and not be up and running fully until the 2030s, although it would be doing some low-level waste earlier than that. That's just a lot of cost overrun and a lot of time that's gone by, and to see if it really can get off the ground. Then the other thing is, can we clean the site up with all the infrastructure that's aging? So if you think about an old road, like the road just gets older, it gets more potholes, it gets weathered, it starts crumbling on the edges. Well, that's happening with all of Hanford's roads. So just to get to the cleanup sites, they have to maintain all those roads, and that costs money. And then all the electricity and all the buildings all have to be maintained until you can finally get all the cleanup done. So what happens is that it grows, the amount of money just to keep the infrastructure going grows and grows and grows, and the actual cleanup dollars shrink and shrink and shrink. So can you beat that time clock? I'm wondering, you know, in a few decades, where we'll be on the cleanup.
KUOW reporter Anna King telling you how that tunnel collapse at Hanford happened and about the other nuclear waste cleanup issues there on KUOW's The Record. Coming up this afternoon, the great playwright Edward Albee, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, he declared in his will that when he died, any unpublished manuscripts were to be destroyed. But when he did die, some people said, "Don't honor that will. We want to see his unfinished work. He won't mind." We'll tell you how that's working out on KUOW's All Things Considered. The big political news here in Washington is the new state budget that our governor just signed. Well, at least we have a governor. The leader next door in British Columbia is out of office. Let's get the story from Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Hiya, Bill. We're still in transition up here in British Columbia. You're quite right.
Right. For those who don't remember, haven't heard our conversations up to this point, why is the British Columbia premier out of power and a new one on the way?
Well, we had a close call election in May 9th that no party won a majority of seats in the legislature. It took a long time to do the recounts. Then we had negotiations to try to put together some kind of agreement. That took a while. Then the government clung to power for a few more weeks. And finally, last week, our legislature met, and the government of Premier Christy Clark was defeated in the legislature on a motion of confidence. So she had to go to our lieutenant governor, who's the kind of stand-in for the monarch, and say, look, I'm going to resign. She tried to talk the lieutenant governor into calling another election. No dice. So we're now into the final phase of transition. Essentially what's happened is John Horgan, who's the leader of the New Democratic Party, our slightly left of center party here in BC, is going to be forming a government fairly soon with the support of the Green Party of British Columbia. So they will take office in the next couple of weeks. They haven't quite set the date yet, but we think about the middle of the month. And then we're into a new government, the first change of government we've had in British Columbia, Bill, in 16 years. So it's a time of great change. And nowhere in Canada has there ever been a government that, of course, had a partnership with the Greens. So that's unexplored territory as well.
Yes, help us through this, Vaughn, because your party names can be confusing to Americans. The old premier is with the Liberals.
Which aren't liberal.
Yeah.
And the New Democratic Party is neither new nor particularly much like the American Democrats. So, no, it's okay. So the Liberals are a center-right party. They include small L liberals, but they also include a lot of conservatives and right-wingers. And then you moving across the political spectrum, you get to the New Democrats. They are the party of the center-left. And then the Greens, well, you know, you can get a big argument with the Greens on some issues, especially the environment. They're far to the left, but on the other hand, on some issues, they're a little more libertarian and that sort of thing. So it's not quite a coalition that we're getting here. When they do coalitions, usually you get some cabinet jobs as well. The Greens are going to support the New Democrats. They're not seeking cabinet jobs, so they want to retain some of their independence. But there's little question that we're certainly headed for very different changes on a whole bunch of issues. One that I think we'll be looking to your part of the world on is we're getting a $15 an hour minimum wage phased in over several years. And I'm sure people in Washington State will be aware that is a very controversial proposal.
Yes, indeed. First, we should say this is $15 Canadian.
So it's not like it's real money. Yeah.
No offense. We have been, debating here. We've had dueling studies about whether a rising minimum wage toward $15 has been good for low-wage workers overall or bad for low-wage workers.
Yeah, and I think that debate will continue. The people who oppose the change here in British Columbia, of course, cite the studies that show it's been bad. The people who support the change here in British Columbia cite the studies that it shows it's been good. Overall, you know, we had the minimum wage here frozen for a long time, and they started increasing it slightly in 2011. It's up, it's just below $11 now. I don't think it's had a huge amount of negative impact here. The government is talking about phasing it into 15 over 4 years. That's probably gradual enough that it won't have huge shocks on the economy. And at the low end of the income scale in British Columbia, you know, Vancouver is one of the most expensive places around to live in. I think it'll help people there. Victoria, where I live, the capital, is also a pretty expensive place. So I have a lot of sympathy for the people at that end of the wage scale. I think there are much bigger economic issues for us to be worrying about here in British Columbia.
So you have a new premier coming in, the new Democrat, John Horgan, who I understand called the Liberals Klingons?
Yeah, he's a Star Trek fan. This is great, right? So John Horgan loves science fiction. He has a little group in his party which he calls the Geek Caucus, and he's co-chair. And he's been known to refer to the government as the Klingons, and going into question period in the legislature is engaging the Borg. So Star Trek fans are having a great deal of fun. He has Star Trek socks, he has a Star Trek pin, and he showed up in the legislature wearing them when Leonard Nimoy died last year. So we've got a Trekkie in office, so I guess Star Trek fans prefer to be called Trekkers, not Trekkies.
Right. The new premier tried out for a role as an extra in the Star Trek movie that you shot in Vancouver.
That's right. And the other picture we've been using the last few days, Bill, is one where to raise money for a sexual assault center for women, he took part in a Walk a Mile in Our Shoes campaign, which saw him walking down the halls of the legislature in a lovely pair of pink pumps. Very great picture.
But
he's got a personality and a sense of humor, and that's always nice with a politician.
Is that pink pump picture, is that beard or no beard? Because I understand that's a bit of a kerfuffle.
Yeah. And this is funny. He went on a holiday with his wife and shaved the beard off. And then he came back, and the party had to explain to him that they had shot all of their campaign posters, videos, attack ads with him bearded, and he had to grow it back because they couldn't afford, they didn't have enough money to reshoot everything. So he's growing it back. In fact, he started growing it back before the election.
How do you like that? You rise to the position of premier of your province, and you can't even get to decide whether you wear a beard or not. He's got to.
You'll be our first bearded premiers in 90 years. So maybe we're getting a style back. I don't know.
Congratulations. That's Vaughn Palmer, columnist, Vancouver Sun, letting you know about the government just north of here. Thank you, Vaughn.
Bye-bye, Bill.